This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
When we scheduled a book with the title, What Have We Done? Just several days after the presidential vote, we hadn't been anticipating what happened. But here we are. Actually, though the title does capture what a lot of us may be feeling about the election, the book by David Wood is, of course, about something entirely different. And it's really a great book. It's about war, and more specifically about the lasting moral injury to many troops who have served in Afghanistan and Iraq. Moral injury is a kind of a psychic trauma, but it's not the same as PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. David is going to explain the difference in a minute, how prevalent it has become as a result of the length and nature of the Afghan and Iraq wars, and what is or isn't being done to treat it. David is especially well suited to be writing about all this, having spent several decades as a journalist covering armed conflicts and reporting on U.S. forces. Since his journalism career began in 1970, it has taken him to conflicts in Europe, Central Asia, Africa, the Middle East, Southwest Asia. I guess that covers everywhere except what, like the South Pole and the North Pole. He's been all over and with all kinds of troops. A series he wrote for the Huffington Post on severely wounded American veterans of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq won the Pulitzer for national reporting 4 years ago. At that time, a biographical note about him that the Pulitzer Committee posted included a sentence that said, David, referring to his many experiences with the military, has been scared much of his professional life. I got to know David during my own time reporting on the Pentagon beat for the Washington Post, and can vouch for the very high regard in which he's held by other journalists for his knowledgeable, insightful, and very gracefully written stories. There's also somebody here who grew up with David, who said that even in his early days, he was, what did she say, charming and dashing? Did I get that right? Charming and dashing. In a review of his new book, Publishers Weekly said David, quote, delivers searing, elegantly told reportage on a little understood and long ignored facet of war. And Kirk has called the work a welcome contribution to the still not very well understood field of studies about war trauma. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Wood.
Good evening, book lovers. Thank you for being here on this special Veterans Day. I'm really honored. Well, can I just say, this place is such a haven for book lovers, book writers, book readers, people like me who like to smell new books. I mean, this is just a great place. So, Brad, thank you for having this place and for inviting me to speak here. This is really pretty nice. After that introduction, I'm sort of tempted to say, well, anybody have any questions? So I want to talk tonight about moral injury, and I guess a quick way to sum up the idea of moral injury is that it's a violation of our sense of what's right. So we all walk around with a pretty complete and sometimes complex moral code, right, that we begin learning as infants, and then we learn from our parents, from school, church, synagogue, mosque, from the street. We learn, don't hit girls, and, sharing is good, all that kind of stuff. And then when you join the military, there's a whole new set of moral values that you're required to learn, and these are the, you know, the ordinary things like duty, honor, country. And the most important value that the military teaches and enforces is you take care of your buddies no matter what. So you get off the bus at the Marine Recruit Depot or Army Basic Training, and almost the first thing the drill sergeant says is, this is your buddy, you're responsible for him no matter what. And of course, nobody takes that seriously, and you get out to the obstacle course and the weak guy in your platoon can't get over the obstacle, and so you know, the entire platoon is punished, and the next day you help him over the obstacle. And from that little seed grows among men and women who are sent to war a really deep, passionate, profound love for each other. I know, you know, we call it camaraderie, but that's kind of a weasel word. It's really love. It's a total commitment physically and mentally and morally to each other. And that's kind of a dangerous thing, because when you go to war, bad things happen, and that sense of what's right is just under assault all the time. So, quick example. In the book, I write about a Marine named Nick, really a nice kid. And I call them kids because they are young. Just an aside, I passed out this photograph. These are Marines that I went to war with and came under fire with in Afghanistan. They are a platoon of Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 6th Marine Regiment, or Charlie 1-6, and I'll probably refer to them a couple of times tonight as Charlie 1-6. Look at how young they are. Look at those faces, even though a couple of them sort of have on their war faces, like trying to look, you know, pretty stern. And actually, this is their second combat tour, so they're pretty seasoned war fighters. In 2007, this picture was taken in 2010. In 2007, 3 years before that, when a lot of these kids were recruited, the Pentagon was trying to get the manpower to power up those two hot wars that were going on. And that year, 2007, they recruited 7,500 17-year-olds. And altogether that year, the class of recruits who were 17 years to 20 years, so not yet 21, 86,000. Half of the Marines on active duty hadn't reached their 21st birthday. So if any of you have teenagers at home or are teenagers or remember when you were teenagers, you know that the executive function of the brain hasn't fully developed yet, right? And especially that part of the brain which enables you to assess the moral consequences of your actions. So those are the kids that we sent into the most morally complex wars in our history. Anyway, I was telling a story about Nick Rudolph. So Nick is a really nice Marine, comes with his pretty intact sense of moral values, gets in a firefight, bad firefight that went on for hours and hours and hours, and at one point, the Taliban were holed up in a farm compound surrounded by an adobe wall, and they were firing at the Marines who were advancing, trying to flush out the bad guys. And at one point, Nick sees someone coming around the corner of the building, shooting at him and his Marines with a semi-automatic rifle, gets that person in his sights and realizes that's like a 12-year-old kid, and shoots him dead. So in that circumstance, pardon me, was the perfectly legal and tactically correct thing to do, right? Because there's an enemy combatant taking you under lethal fire. You have the right to defend yourself. You could even say it was the morally correct thing to do, because Nick is protecting himself and his Marines. Remember, take care of your buddy no matter what. Even if it means killing a child, yeah. So you could argue that it was the morally correct thing to do. But he killed a child, and that's not okay. And in Nick's moral code, you don't kill children. And so Nick, now home, out of the Marine Corps, you know, he's someone who goes forward into life with this moral, with this bruise on his soul, really, that doesn't go away. So I grew up as a Quaker, and I was a conscientious objector during Vietnam, and became a journalist, and then through a series of accidents I became a war correspondent. And to much to my mother's surprise and I think chagrin. And so I've spent since 1977, I guess, was the first time I got shot at as a correspondent or as anything, really. And I spent most of that time either by myself reporting on wars or as an embedded reporter. And the reason I kept going back to it, in spite of disruptions to my family and personal discomfort and sort of moral questioning about what was going on, the reason I kept going back was I spent my time with what I call the working class military. So not the generals. I've really never spent a lot of time with generals, but the people I hung out with were the mostly enlisted, mostly young, people who got their hands dirty. So the wrench turners, the trigger pullers, the jet aircraft mechanics, the guys on that handle aircraft on the decks of aircraft carriers, the guys in the motor pool, the mechanics, the truck drivers, and so forth. And the reason I kept going back and living with these folks is because I really liked them. I remember I grew up in a Quaker family. We didn't know anybody in the military. And if we had, we thought we probably wouldn't like them much. So this was a change for me. But I just found them really attractive. They're really their best kids that we have that we send out there. Their incredible work ethic, their spontaneous generosity has just blew me away. And their unfailing sense of humor, usually black humor, but I've never laughed so hard as I have being an embedded reporter. And I'd spend weeks and weeks or months with these guys. And by the way, when I say guys, I mean men and women. I just found it deeply fulfilling. And because I admired them so much, it took me a long time to figure out, you know, that they were coming home and they weren't okay. And they certainly weren't disabled or crazy, homeless, drug addicted, the insulting stereotype that you sometimes hear. But they weren't okay. And it took me a long time to figure that out. I want to read something really briefly, and then we'll get to questions pretty sick. I want to read from chapter 7, which is called Grief as a Combat Injury. And I led this chapter off with a poem that was written by someone who I had the huge privilege to get to know before he died. He was a World War II Marine. He wrote this poem from Iwo Jima in March 1945, and it's called The Fallen. So I'll just read that and then we'll go into the chapter. The fallen, the buddies, the sharers of foxholes, the teller of stories, the dreamers without words, the singers without music, our fallen. We clasp them once and for good, mightily, tearfully, each to our breast. So that was written by Dan Levin, Marine Staff Sergeant. So here's my chapter. You know what? Sorry, I gotta get my glasses out. On a routine combat patrol outside of Marja in January 2010, a squad of Marines from 2nd Platoon, Charlie 1-6, the guys in your picture, crept cautiously toward an adobe compound in a farm village, hunting a Taliban gang who were making and planting IEDs, the deadly bombs responsible for the majority of American dead and wounded. At the head of the patrol was Lance Corporal Zachary Smith, Smitty. He was 19 years old, taller than his dad, a New York State trooper, but with his dad's engaging grin. Growing up in small town Hornell, New York, he'd been deeply affected by the terror attacks on 9/11. When he was in the sixth grade, he'd glued an image of Osama bin Laden on a cardboard box and took pot shots at it with his grandfather's .22 caliber rifle. Before he left Camp Lejeune with 1-6 that November, Smitty had gone home and married his high school sweetheart, Ann. Now he was barely a month into his first combat experience. As he stepped carefully, an IED suddenly erupted beneath him, tearing off his legs and scything down other Marines with shrapnel and blast wounds. Corporal Zachary Auclair rushed to save him, kneeling and frantically pulling out tourniquets and bandages and Eau Claire was soon bathed in Smitty's blood. Watch for the second one. Watch for the second one. The Taliban often laid IED traps in pairs of bombs, and the senior leader on the patrol, 28-year-old platoon sergeant Daniel Angus, was frantically warning his Marines, and then he himself stepped on the second IED. The blast blew him apart, killing him instantly, and spraying Eau Claire with blood and viscera. In the chaos, Staff Sergeant Warren Repture, wounded in the face by shrapnel, was on the radio calling for a medevac bird, and Smitty lay dying in Eau Claire's arms. It is difficult to comprehend the emotional shock and grief that slammed into the Marines of Charlie 16. Of course, they realized they were at war, and they knew, as they often said, that bad shit happens. What lingers after the, So the emotional shock didn't come from surprise as much as from the catastrophic loss of deeply loved comrades, obliterated in an instant of horror, seared forever into the souls of the survivors. What lingers after the shock wears off is the deep moral injury of grief, perhaps the most common psychological wound of the generation that fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. The pain that these men and women carry is not only the most common emotion, but perhaps the most difficult to share with outsiders. The survivors often feel guilt for having not spotted the IED that killed their buddies, or for surviving when buddies go home in body bags. Many veterans find it impossible to convey the depth of emotion that binds members of a small unit, like 2nd Platoon in your picture there, and why each combat death cuts so deep. Coming together as they do, these emotions of grief, sorrow, shame, guilt, and loss endure as a powerful moral injury. So that's from chapter 7. So one of the reasons why I chose that to read is to contrast what they were feeling with PTSD. So PTSD was invented by the American Psychiatric Association at, towards the, well, 10 years after most troops were withdrawn from Vietnam, so in 1980. And what the APA said was, if you'd been terrified and thinking you were going to lose your life immediately, it kicked off an automatic response, the fight or flight syndrome or response, which is involuntary. And we all know what this is. I feel it every time I'm going up the metro escalator and I tripped, and as I catch myself, the back of my neck flushes. You know, that's the beginning of fight or flight. I'm not really terrified. I'm embarrassed and humiliated, but you know what I'm talking about, right? In full-blown fight or flight, the stress hormones, cortisol and adrenaline, pour into your bloodstream. They increase your heart rate, your eyes, your vision becomes more acute, your muscles are pumped up with energy, and it's completely involuntary. So in combat, this is a great thing to happen, right? Because it enables you to do the things you need to do in combat. The problem comes when you come home, and I often think of the veteran, combat veteran with PTSD who comes home and as a special treat takes the family to Walmart, for a special outing. And he gets into Walmart and something, crowd noise, bright lights, a slamming of a shopping cart, something kicks off, you know, and all of a sudden he's like in full-blown fight or flight, and you know, he starts sweating and all those things start happening to him, and he starts running outside. His wife says, "Honey, what's wrong with you? You know, this was supposed to be a treat for the kids," and he's got all this energy which he can't burn off, so he slams his fist into a post and attracts the attention of the security guards, of course. And, you know, finally gets home and he's, you know, frantic and worried. What's happening to me? I feel like I'm going crazy. I don't understand this. And that night he can't sleep because he's worried it's going to happen again. And the next day he's exhausted and does poorly at work. And you can see the whole thing happening here. So that's a big problem. But I know guys with PTSD. I once trained for a couple of weeks with a different Marine battalion, and we were going to go to Iraq together. And part of the training was there was this mock combat town, and squads would maneuver through this, and there were real Iraqis there, so we get used to the language, and suicide bombers, and the exercise controllers would set off these mock explosions, so there was a lot of loud noise. And Sergeant Kowalski, I noticed every time, you know, there was an explosion, he'd jump like that. I didn't think anything of it. When we got to Iraq, been there for a while, and I said to somebody one day, you know, where's Sergeant Kowalski? I haven't heard him. Oh, you know, we had to leave him behind. He said, why? What happened? He's got PTSD bad. And I was like, oh, yeah, I remember how he jumped. So that's PTSD. So Nick, the Marine who killed the child, he wasn't scared at that point. You know, his fight or flight syndrome wasn't activated. He had a moral injury. There's a huge difference. Now, part of the problem, and the reason why I bring this up and dwell on it is because almost all of the therapy that the VA has come up with to deal with veterans who are having mental health issues involve therapy for PTSD. And where that therapy comes from is from clinical research on people who've been raped or in car accidents. And it only recently began to become clear that none of this therapy works on veterans who have PTSD because wartime PTSD is different. It, for one thing, it tends to happen over and over and over again. Some of the therapy is, I think it's called extinction therapy, and the idea is, you know, if you've had a really scary experience, if you talk about it over and over and over and over again, it begins to lose its power. Well, you know, if you've shot a child and you got to tell that story over and over and over again, it makes you feel worse. It drives that moral injury deeper into your soul. So we've got a lot of work to do. The VA is beginning to wake up to the whole notion of, pardon me, moral injury. I know a couple of VA psychologists who are really into this and doing really interesting work. The Marine Corps has gone leaps and bounds ahead of everybody in recognizing moral injury as an injury that's the same as a physical injury, and recognizing it such, and training people to recognize it, and doing a lot of interesting research on how to deal with it. But by and large, no. So I'm going to finish up here really quick. It occurred to me that, you know, listening to the Marines tell me these stories, and again, they were telling me these stories because I'd been with them in Iraq or Afghanistan. But telling those stories was so cathartic for them, and it's hard. You know, Nick told that story to me because he trusted me, because, you know, we'd been in Afghanistan. But I don't think he's told anybody else. In fact, he asked me one time, you know, do you think I should tell my girlfriend about this? You know, I said, dude, it's in the book. She's going to know. So you better tell her. but it's hard for them to talk about it. I think that really real healing of these veterans is not going to happen until they can talk about it. And we have a role to play there, I think. And one of the things I learned from the Marines, when Nick told this story, we were sitting in a hotel room in Philadelphia. We'd put away a lot of beer. They were talking, and my tape recorder was running. And after he told this story, there was a long silence. And then one of the Marines said something that I've come to think of as the perfect response to a story like that. It's a response of validation. It's a response that doesn't say, as I was tempted to blurt out, you know, Nick, don't worry about it, you know, if you couldn't help it, or it was war, or it was him or you, and all those kind of weaselly excuses that we have that really don't validate his experience. What one of the other Marines said was, yeah, that was fucked up. It's such a great phrase, that was fucked up. And it's great because it, you know, recognizes, yeah, that was bad. But it happened in the past, and it's over. It was a discrete event that's over. And there's no blame attached, right? You know? And we're still here. We still love you. You're Nick, our buddy. And so I'd like you to use some similar kind of phrase. You don't have to use the exact Marine word, but having that response, encouraging, getting to know veterans, encouraging them to tell their stories or tell a little bit about their experience, and then reacting to it with validation, I think will be the beginning of healing. So with that, I'd be love to have your questions, catcalls, boos, disagreements, or comments. And by the way, Brad asked me to make sure that when you ask a question, go to one of the microphones so we can record you for posterity and come after you if you.
Good evening, Mr. Wood. I'm very glad to be here because I work with veterans and I work for veterans, particularly helping them with compensation claims. And I never really thought of this, but it did remind me of a film I saw on the My Lai massacre. There's one in particular, and they interview the people who were there and who killed women and children, and how deeply it hurt them. So if anything, you know, epitomize a moral injury. Today we have another aspect of warfare, though, in the technology is the drones. And the people who sit apart, way, you know, they're not in any danger, and they're being asked to take lives of it, and they don't even know. But it reminded me also of a man named Howard Zinn, who was in the B-17s, and he came to feel regret about the bombs that came down, and he didn't know what they were hitting, but of course at the time it was, but he just, I just picked up a book and he wrote something. We live in a beautiful country, but people who have no respect for human life, freedom, or justice have taken it over. It is now up to all of us to take it back. Where do we go from here?
Well, thanks for the question. It's a great question. One of the things that has become clear as we've looked into the experiences of men and women in Iraq and Afghanistan is that taking another human life, killing someone, imposes a cost on the killer, right? And so there's a lot of interesting research being done by a VA psychiatrist in San Francisco named Shira McGinn, and she has done clinical research on people who have killed and veterans who have not killed. And what she's found is that veterans who've killed in combat are twice as likely to develop serious mental health issues later on in life than people who didn't kill in combat. And that people who killed a civilian in combat were even more likely to develop serious mental health issues. So we know killing is bad for you. And I've had long talks with these Marines about killing, and one of them, who's Chuck Newton, who's in that picture, he's the guy, I think he's on the upper right, and he's carrying what looks like a bazooka over his shoulder, and he's got kind of a smirk on his face. You know, what he told me is, he said, I went to war to kill, and I've killed a lot, and the psychological burden of that is something I'll never get over. And he said, you should never be killing a member of your own species. He's a pretty thoughtful kid. And from him I've learned that killing does impose a cost on the people we send into combat. But killing is one of the things we don't talk about, right? We never talk about the whole purpose of having a military is to kill people, or to threaten to kill people, or to have the capability of killing them. And it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, one of the soldiers I've written about in a very difficult situation came face to face with an insurgent in Iraq and thrust a knife into his chest and killed him as he looked into his eyes as the guy was dying, and was just devastated by that. So we don't talk about killing. We send people into war and we never tell them, you know, you should be prepared. If you do your duty and do what you're supposed to do and follow all the rules and all the moral values you've been taught, you're going to have a problem. And, you know, so one of the things I think we need to do is start acknowledging that war is bad, whether you're killing by drone, whether you're a drone pilot sitting in Las Vegas, which is where most of them are, or you're a B-52 bombardier, or you're killing somebody face to face with your K-bar knife. So, where I thank you for that question, and I hope I've begun to answer it a little bit. And thank you for the work you do.
Yeah, I'm not a veteran, but I do help veterans, and I'm very happy.
Good.
Can you talk a little bit about what it means to these veterans to have served and sacrificed so much for a war or wars that are now generally believed to have been mistakes? It's one thing if you're coming back and saying, we stopped Hitler, but when your whole society says, wow, we went in for the wrong reasons, we shouldn't have done that. Do they talk about that? How does that affect how they process their experiences?
Yeah. Excuse me. One of the things that I learned hanging out with the working class of the military is that they don't have a big picture. They don't care about the big picture. What they care about is their little piece of it. So the Marines of Charlie Company 1-6 had a little a sector in the town of Marja in Afghanistan in 2010, and they fought hard over that territory, and they lost a lot of guys, and they bled for it, and they came home proud of what they did. You know, I was sometimes tempted to say, well, you know, things aren't going so well in Afghanistan. They're not even paying attention. Now, I'm drawing huge generalities here, and I don't speak for them. But of what they've told me, you know, they did their part. They're proud of what they did, really proud. And they know people weren't paying attention here. They know most people didn't go. They don't. Well, I should say, a number of them have said that that really bothers them. But they're still proud of what they did. So, you know, I was writing a story about Afghanistan the other day, and things aren't going there well at all. And I talked to a number of veterans, and they were like, well, what'd you expect, you know? And it never went well. And a lot of them think war never goes well, which is where I meet them from my pacifist background. I think many, many combat veterans believe that war is just bad, but still proud of what they did. Yes, sir.
With your knowledge of the soldiers in Afghanistan as well as Iraq, what would you recommend in regard to other books besides your own that really give the nitty-gritty of the experience of fighting in those wars?
There's no other books like this. Sebastian Younger's written a couple of good books, and I recommend them. He's a good writer, and he captures, again, the experience of the working class military. I'm reading a really good book right now, which I bought here, and I don't remember the name of it, but it's about the British expeditions to Mount Everest in 1921, 22, and 24. And that's a war book because I didn't realize, I know a lot about the guys that climbed Mount Everest, I didn't realize that the reason they did that was they were so horrified by their experiences in the war. And the guys who did that climbing were all had horrifying experiences in France because they needed some kind of purification and to do something so noble and pure, and that's what they found. That's a great book, and I wish, where's Brad? I wish I could remember the name of it, but it's here somewhere in the adventure section.
How about Redeployment?
That's another good one.
Group of short
Yellow
stories.
Birds is another good one. Mm-hmm. Tim O'Brien's famous What They Carried is a great one.
The Things They Carried.
Dispatches. I mean, mm-hmm. Also, What It Is Like to Go to War. Who wrote that?
Marlandis.
Thank you, Jeff. Marlandis, right. And he wrote another one called Matterhorn, which is phenomenal. So there's a lot of good books. Mm-hmm. All Quiet on the Western Front, of course, is a classic.
Johnny Got His Gun.
There you go.
Fantastic.
You probably know more about this than
Dalton Trumbo. Can't beat
right.
it.
All right. Well, thanks for your question.
Sure.
Yes, sir.
I was going to mention Marlanis.
Thank you.
The book that you mentioned, that the real thesis is that if we look back at ancient societies and tribal groups, they seem to recognize that the act of killing another human being, even when justified by your society's rules, is still a violation of something deep, that you leave your society and you go into a sacred space, that there was a tremendous amount of ritual associated to going to war, but equally, when you came back, you were not fit to rejoin your society until you had been purified by ritual coming back.
Yeah, well,
and I think that there was a twofold message, and the one was that only soldiers can do that for themselves, and secondly, the society that sends people to kill needs to grapple with the gravity and the scope of the moral harm, and I don't think we even begin to,
because we're
shopping. You know, we were told to go shopping.
Yeah. No, I mean, look in the Bible. I think it's in the Book of Numbers. Moses says, you know, if you've killed in battle, you got to stay outside of camp for 7 days and get purified. And 1066, Battle of Hastings, the Archbishop of Canterbury said, if you have killed in combat, you have to do 1 day of penance a week for the rest of your life. I mean, this was serious stuff. And I think still Native American communities, a lot of them have this culture of requiring warriors to go through a process of cleansing and acceptance. And a lot of people say forgiveness, and I'm not really sure about the forgiveness piece, but acceptance at least, what I was talking about, listening with validation. But we don't do any of that. We just completely, as you say, we went, you know, shopping. Just, I hope there's a way we can reclaim that practice somehow. I'm not sure how to do it. Yes, sir.
Hi, I came into the store tonight to pick up a November calendar, and then I saw your book. I, like thousands of others, have been a highly overpaid civilian contractor in Kabul, Afghanistan as well, and Baghdad. And I'm wondering if there's any comparable study of people like me. And I was able to avoid Vietnam because I joined the Peace Corps. So I've worked in 26 countries. What I'm curious about, and I hadn't thought about the moral dimensions of my work, except I do the best I can for what I see right immediately are hopeless projects and situations where billions of dollars are just being thrown away on people like me. Is there any equivalent study of the civilian contractor who's making lots of good money for hopeless causes?
There are some studies of the effect of war, of trauma on civilian contractors. And, you know, I'm sure you have your own personal stories, and I obviously can't speak for you, but I think in general, contractors and a lot of people in the military got into that with the idea of doing something noble. That, as President Bush said, the Iraqis, as they stand up, we'll stand down. That was the whole point. We didn't go to win a war. We went to help people. And, you know, even though many people had came back with a lot of pride in what they accomplished in their lane, overall, the enterprise wasn't so noble, and we didn't help people. In fact, they were trying to kill us. So that didn't work out so well. And I think that may be partly what you're alluding to. I think many people came back feeling like that wasn't quite okay, and it did sort of violate my sense of what's right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Maybe you ought to interview this guy. Might be fucking
good idea. Yes, sir.
I think that Mike.
Oh. Heather, your turn.
Should we identify this is the woman who remembers
Dave? He's still charming and dashing. I found the book incredibly powerful, both personally moving and incredibly disturbing, and felt that unlike some other books that tell a story about war or other stories, that I actually felt that it was a call to action or implied a call to action. And so while people are here, and I know we've discussed this a little bit, about things people can do, things we can do, because here, just for some of the areas, there's now an alternate treatment. The VA could decide to explore that. There's a new Congress and Senate. There may be little that the parties can agree on, but perhaps they can agree on a different kind of treatment and different kind of attention to veterans and to people who are moved into the military, perhaps even make them more cautious about making that move. But it feels like this could lead to some action that the audiences who hear about your book or who read it can actually take to change some of that moral injury and to take the lesson and turn it into action. I wondered if you have comments on things you think we can do.
Well, thanks, Heather. I am not naturally an activist. I'm a reporter, so I probably won't take an active part in that kind of thing you're talking about, but I certainly am starting an effort to speak to as many people as I can around the country. You know, in this country, there are 43,000 organizations that deal with veterans. And I'm probably not going to visit all of them, but I'm going to get to a lot of them. And however people choose to take action, I think is a good idea. The book is being sent to people in Congress, especially the chairmen and chairwomen of the appropriate committees. I hope people take some kind of action. I think it will be a highly personal kind of thing, what you decide to do, but I hope to spur people to action because something needs to be done. Thank you, Heather. Yes, sir.
So that actually was part of what, I was going to ask. She's asked it so elegantly. So I'll perhaps ask two follow-up points. So one is about, so at this stage, how big a problem is this and how much is being done, you know? So how much resource are we actually devoting to it? Mm-hmm. And the second is, are there any lessons from other countries, has this issue been, actually talked about anywhere else, like in Europe, for example, and is there anything that we could learn from them? Thank you.
Yeah, on that second point, the Israeli Defense Forces have really moved into this issue big time. And they're spending a lot of time doing research and talking about it. So there's that. I haven't seen any comparable thing from Europe or anywhere else. On your first point, people always ask me, how big a problem is this? I have no idea. I don't think anybody has any idea. Because kids like Nick Rudolph, who shot the child, comes home and melts back into civilian society and deals with his problems alone. And I think a lot of people fall into that category. The VA can't make anybody come in for treatment. It has to be voluntary. And so with no formal moral injury repair program, I think it wouldn't occur to most people, even if they knew what moral injury was, to come to the VA for help. So it's a very sporadic and individual kind of thing. And I think most people, so there was a program at the San Diego Naval Hospital in Balboa, in San Diego. And there was a big PTSD program. The people who were running it thought, most of these guys don't have PTSD. They have moral injury. So they sort of very quietly, because the military doesn't recognize moral injury, changed it over to a moral injury repair group, informally. But that ended, and it's been disbanded, and the people have left. And so there's not a lot going on. It was the San Diego Naval Hospital, and it was called the Moral Injury Repair Group. And it was Michael Castellana and I can't remember who else was running it. And like I said, Michael left. The other woman who was a psychiatrist also left to go somewhere else. The group was disbanded, and it is no more.
Well, after your book, I think it's an issue that we really should be systematically studying. I think it should be pretty simple to try and define the extent of the problem. We should know, you know, how many of our veterans have actually done something like this and, you know, how many are hurting. We should not really allow them to get to a much later stage in life without even knowing, you know, that this has been troubling them. So, you know, really appreciate your book. Thank you.
It's an uphill battle. There's a VA psychiatrist in Boston by the name of Brett Litz, who's done a lot of really good research on this. He, earlier this year, finished a proposal to expand his clinical research on what kind of therapies really help people with moral injury, shopped it around, and he never got the grant. So that came to an end. So it is an uphill battle. Yes, sir.
Have you done any work about, have you broken down what happens to combatants once they come back? How many are successful? How many end up in jail? How many are drug addicted? Has there been a breakdown of that?
I have not done that. There are studies like that. The reason why I didn't get into that deeply is because, you know, there's no direct correlation between moral injury and drug addiction. You know, I know people who've gotten addicted to drugs when they've been deployed, and in a lot of cases, that's, you know, in combat units, if you were having trouble sleeping, you could get any drug you wanted. Just, you know, it was just handed out like candy. When you got back to the States, that was really strictly controlled. So you had to go out on the street, and a lot of guys got bounced out of the military because they were buying illegal drugs to which they got addicted at the battalion aid station in Iraq or Afghanistan. So, but I didn't see any direct correlation, so I didn't include any of that in my book. But the data's out there. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes. This is not so much a question as a response to what Heather was saying. In your book, you mention Quaker House in Fayetteville, North Carolina. They're a nationwide organization. They run the GI Rights Hotline. They work with domestic abuse. They work with soldiers wanting to become people already in the military, wanting to become conscientious objectors. And they also have a very large moral injury program. They're working on it every day. So if anyone wants more information, just, you know, Google Quaker House, Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Yeah, right outside of Fort Bragg. Mm-hmm. And they've been trying to get into Fort Bragg to work with the chaplains to do presentations on moral injury to the soldiers in the 82nd Airborne and other soldiers there. And I think they've not been successful yet, but they're working on it. So that's good. Yes.
Hi. I don't work with veterans. I came because I have a different background interest. So I worked for a while in Bosnia with victims of war crimes and their family members. And I was really struck with by the way that you opened when you're talking about how veterans learn new norms. And one of them is that your highest priority is to save your buddy. And there's another group that really feels like that. And those are mostly, it happens to be mothers, but it's family members who feel that same sense of helplessness that they could not protect the people that they loved in wartime. And so what I wanted to say is that in that population also, people talk about PTSD and see their root symptoms, which are very similar to what you described to veterans, as being caused by the fear, the chronic fear that they had to live through. But when I talk to mothers, what they really express is this deep betrayal of some kind of fundamental norm of society. And you can look at other non-combat areas, chronic domestic violence, where I think also people conceptualize PTSD as coming from the fear and the threat that you're under, but there's also an aspect of having been betrayed in this fundamental relationship where, you know, the people that you grow up with, whether it's domestic abuse or sexual abuse, the people you grow up with are supposed to love you and protect you, and that doesn't happen. And so there are some psychologists who have written about the betrayal aspect of trauma, and I just wondered if you looked at that at all. And then I just flipping through the book quickly, noticed that you've talked a little bit about how the need to try and comply with the Geneva Conventions complicates the sense of moral injury. If you could talk about that aspect as well.
Yeah. So on the first point, yeah, betrayal is a huge part of moral injury. And I think the where I saw that the most was in people who signed up. You know, I spent a lot of time talking to kids at basic training and Marine boot camp. And, you know, a lot of them signed up to do something big and noble. And after their first or second deployment, they realized, you know, that really wasn't so big and noble, and a sense of betrayal that their country sent them out to do something big, and it wasn't that good. So betrayal is a big part of it. The other part of your question was,
the
Geneva Conventions.
Yeah. Table. So it's about the Geneva Conventions, how that complicates the moral injury, and whether did you look at people who were specifically being asked to violate those norms, and how that affected moral injury? Like, there's a difference between like sort of being caught in a situation where the judgment is so hard to make.
Yeah. You know, I haven't run into many situations where people were asked directly to do something illegal under the Geneva Conventions. It just happens all the time. It's part of war. And so, you don't kill killing civilians is outlawed under the Geneva Conventions and under American legal rules and under the rules of engagement, which the combatant commands right. But it happens all the time. And the reason it happens all the time is because in these wars, what is a civilian? You know, what about the school kid who's paid a dollar to drop an IED in a hole on his way to school? Is he a combatant or a civilian? You know, what about, and this happened a lot, a bunch of Marines go out and patrol, and they see a guy with watching them in binoculars, and he gets on his cell phone, and 2 minutes later they get mortared. And then it happens again the next day and next week, and then pretty quickly they figure out, you know, he's spotting. But he doesn't have a weapon, so under Geneva Conventions, you can't touch him. Or another thing that I've seen happen, somebody pops up and takes a shot at soldiers and then drops his weapon. It's like, you can't touch me, I'm a civilian. So if you take your 19-year-old Marine or Army soldier, how does he deal with that situation? It's not that he's been told, you know, go kill some civilians. It's that, you know, he's in combat. He's told the highest moral value for him is you take care of your buddies no matter what. What do you do? So there's that problem. And I think that's probably more prevalent than a commander saying, go out and kill civilians or go torture people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's obvious that during wartime, judgment calls are very difficult.
Yeah.
The norm. It's funny to me that I guess what's difficult about the situation is to reduce what is our very complex, like, legal analysis to on-the-spot judgments that are very rule-based. Those two things kind of together very well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly right. And yet we're asking those young kids to make those snap judgments and live with the consequences for the rest of their life, right? And not to mention the people, the victims.
But I guess what I'm getting is that there are a lot of people who would argue we shouldn't be asking them to make those judgments. We shouldn't be complying or attempting to comply or something like that.
Oh, that's not the case at all. Not at all. No, they're very, very strict rules. And, you know, if you're a Marine rifleman and you take a shot at somebody who's not threatening you directly, everything stops. There's an investigation. You're pulled off the line. I mean, they take that stuff very seriously. So even in the chaos of combat, the military spends a lot of time trying to make sure that everybody complies with the rules insofar as that's possible.
Okay,
we have time
for the last two. Okay. Hi, David. Hey. So nice to see you. I'm Caitlin Thompson. I oversee the suicide prevention program for the VA. Thank you so much for bringing this to light. And clearly, we need to do a lot more work in terms of understanding moral injury, both in the VA and outside of the VA. I'm curious, though, David, I mean, you have been not just in Iraq and Afghanistan. You have been through so many different combat situations. And so I wonder whether or not your experience with observing moral injury is different comparatively in various combat situations. But I also wonder about, we know about secondary trauma. And so I wonder about a secondary moral injury experience, so that even though we're opening ourselves up and you really are asking people to ask people to tell their stories, we also want to make sure that we're protecting ourselves in order to be able to ask. And I would imagine that, and would you in fact have secondary moral injury, which you don't have to answer, but in terms of doing the incredible work that you do. Thanks.
So I have been in a lot of different kinds of wars, and I guess my experience is that moral injury is the same. I spent 4 years in Africa covering guerrilla wars there, and I saw a lot of bad things happen, and I think the experience of combatants and civilians caught on the battlefield is exactly the same as it was in Afghanistan, even though the technology is hugely different. So I think that's a pretty universal human experience. As far as my own, secondary moral injury, I think I hide behind the role of the storyteller. And that's a pretty safe place to be, and a sort of a protected place to be. So I think that's how I've spent most of my career. Last question. Sorry, she was there first, and she's my wife. So,
yeah, I get the wife's privilege of the last question. My name is Beth Freer King. I'm also a journalist, and I'm going to do a really editor type thing, and that is because not everyone's gotten the book and gotten to read it. Can you just kind of tell, just in like 2 minutes, sort of how the book goes and how the chapters are, and some you mentioned Michael Castellanos. I happen to know this, who is the guy in San Diego who has an amazing story to tell in the book, his own background and what led him to that research. Can you just like give people so they have an idea, kind of just generally what you talk about besides the big huge theme? How do you tell your story?
Okay, so basically what I did was I tell stories in this. I tell stories of the people that I've gotten to know in combat, and I tell the stories of several of the caregivers who I've come to know, psychiatrists and counselors. One thing that fascinated me was that the people who spend their lives and professional lives researching moral injury or taking care of people with moral injury, they all had trauma in their, as kids or somewhere in their early part of their lives. And I just found that fascinating because, they understand trauma, and that has come to sort of drive their lives. One of them, Bill Nash, who is the Marine psychiatrist, and now is director of mental health for the Marine Corps. When he was a kid, he grew up in the south side of Chicago in a very Catholic family, a dysfunctional family. And so he used to go to confession on Saturday afternoon. Imagine this, as like a 10-year-old kid, to confess so he could go to mass the next morning as sort of cleansed. And then decades later, he comes to the conclusion that Marines who are traumatized in combat need to be cleansed. There needs to be some kind of ritual of cleansing and forgiveness, and he built that into his psychological practice. So it's just fascinating. So anyway, the book is full of stories like that. There's a chapter on killing. There's a chapter on war crimes. There's halfway through my work on this book, my wife, the editor, said, "So how many women are in your book?" I was like, "Well, it's not that, you know, it's not that many women in combat." And she said, "Well, that's not what you told me." I was like, "Ugh." So I added two new chapters on two women who I know who suffered different kinds of moral injury. So thank you for that suggestion. All right, folks, let's wrap it up, and I'd be happy to sign copies of the book.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.